We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
All right, my name is Dustin. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 6th, 2018, and I'm absolutely grateful for that date. That's not my first sobriety date. I tried to get sober for the first time when I was 15 years old. My first sobriety date was November 16th, 2002. And at that time, I absolutely belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking 2 years before that when I was 13. I told myself that I was never, ever going to take a drink in my whole life. My mom and my dad got sober when I was three. One of my first memories was being at their treatment center graduation, eating little Jell-O mold and feeling really proud of my mom and my dad, not really understanding what alcoholism was or what sobriety was, but knowing that they were proud of themselves and that they were committed to living a different and better way of life. Some of my earliest memories are of my dad telling me that alcoholism is a genetic disease, that it would be dangerous for me to drink or do drugs, and that many, many members of my family had suffered from alcoholism. So I promised myself that I would never drink. And yet when I was 13 years old and my friends started drinking and smoking weed, there I was. And it really didn't take very much thought. I said, okay, I won't drink, but I'll smoke weed. And in eighth grade, I tried it and absolutely loved it. By the summer after my eighth grade year, I remember thinking, after having drank and smoked weed and tried other drugs, that I wanted to live like this for the rest of my life. That if I could just be high forever, things would be great. And I went from being a kid who showed potential, who was happy, to really just being someone who did drugs as much as possible. And when you're 13 and 14 and 15 years old, it isn't necessarily possible to do it every day, but I sure did it as much as I could. I learned how to go into grocery stores and steal alcohol, and I remained drunk and high as much as possible. So when I was 15 years old, after having been suspended from school multiple times, I went out and stole alcohol with some friends one day and drank way too much. I ended up blacked out on my kitchen floor, covered in my own vomit, with the burglar alarm going off. And I wasn't able to tell the burglar alarm company the secret code. And so they called the police and they called my dad, and my dad showed up before the police and he found me. And that was my first trip to treatment, my first time being taken out of school at 15 years old. And what my high school years looked like was spending 2.5 years in places that called themselves treatment centers and looked a lot like jail. And it was hard. And I would go into these centers and I would promise myself that this time I'm going to get sober. And I would get out and I would go to meetings and I would do the things. I would get a sponsor and I would work some steps, and ultimately I would go back out and drink, and then I would get sent back into one of these facilities and spent about 2 years of my high school years in facilities like this, and got a GED while I was in one of those facilities. And at 17 years old, took my first college course through correspondence in the mail. That was just kind of what my life looked like. I was this kid who was smart and had some potential and could be somewhat productive in the time that I was sober, but couldn't stay sober very much. From 17 to 22, I was in a revolving door of Alcoholics Anonymous that a lot of people are probably pretty familiar with. So I would stay sober for sometimes 9 months, sometimes 6 months. One time from the last facility that I was in as a kid through my 18th birthday, I stayed sober for 2.5 years. And my experience in that time period was that I thought about drinking and getting high every single day, multiple times a day. I got myself on a community college campus, and I would see other people going to their car to smoke weed, and I felt jealous and I felt embarrassed that I wasn't able to do that or that I didn't do that. I would go to concerts and have the same exact experience. I felt like there was something wrong with me, that I had to be sober and other people didn't. But the problem was, is when I drank and did drugs, terrible things happened to me. I couldn't stop myself from having run-ins with the law. I couldn't stop myself from hurting my parents. I couldn't stop myself from running away from home, from lying, from stealing. It was like from the age of 15 to 22, my drinking was always in the form of a relapse. And I knew that I would come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that I would probably have to make amends for the behavior that I was doing. But I thought, I better get it out of my system now, because next time I get sober, I'm actually going to be sober for the rest of my life. So I better get this stuff out of my system. And I would go to meetings and I would hear people tell their stories at speaker meetings. And I would feel jealous of all the extra time and experience that some of these people got to have drinking and doing drugs. And I thought that my story would always be boring. And then one day I went out for a relapse. I was 22 years old. I had just broken up with a girlfriend who I met through Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went out to relapse one more time, and it was going to be like every other relapse that I had had. And I didn't make it back to the rooms for 9 years. What happened in that time period was I developed full-blown alcoholism and made it so that I could come to the rooms. I'm living in Des Moines, Iowa in this time, and I graduated from community college after 5 years of being in classes, and I go on this relapse. I have a friend who I met in Alcoholics Anonymous who moved from Des Moines, Iowa to Long Beach, California 1 year prior, and he was doing well. And he said, I don't think what you're doing in Des Moines is working for you. I think you better come out to Long Beach. I'm actually doing really well. I'm drinking like a gentleman. And I think that I can teach you how to do that. And I said, sure. So I planned my life in about the matter of 2 days to come out to Long Beach, California to drink like a gentleman. I let my dad know I'm thinking about moving to California. And then the next day I was on a Greyhound bus. What I didn't realize was that the next day was Mother's Day of 2010. I rolled into Omaha, Nebraska, which is 2 hours away from Des Moines, and realized that it was Mother's Day and that I had left without saying goodbye to my mom. And that's just kind of a really good snapshot of who and what I was in that time period. I could only think about Dustin. So on the Greyhound bus, where I'm heading out to California to drink like a gentleman, by Denver, they wanted to kick me off the bus because it turns out you're not allowed to drink on the Greyhound, which seems a little ridiculous to me because I wasn't driving. But they found my 9 beers in the trash can right behind me. And I had gone to a liquor store at the stop, got myself a bottle of vodka, and was met by the bus driver who said, you're not getting back on the bus. And I cried and begged my way back on and got back on the bus. And by the time I made it to Las Vegas, I went behind the bus stop and smoked a joint. And another guy was back there doing the same exact thing, and he offered me some ecstasy. So by the time I rolled into Los Angeles, California to meet my friend to drink normally, I had been awake for about 30 hours, was high on multiple drugs, and said, I'm here, let's do this. He was living in a studio in Long Beach and working in Redondo Beach, California, and said, you better get a job. And I didn't have much of a resume. I had just graduated from community college, and I had some experience in the food service industry. So I started applying to jobs, and I got myself a job at a little restaurant right on the marina in Redondo Beach. And I promised my friend that things were going to be different. And they weren't. We ultimately moved to the Redondo Beach area from his studio apartment in Long Beach. And 3 months into California, I was driving his truck because I didn't have a car. And I got pulled over and I got my first DUI. Turns out they are a little less forgiving of drinking and driving in California than they were in Des Moines, Iowa when I was a kid. I had gotten pulled over in that condition many, many times. And the cops just kind of looked the other way, but I blew a .09 and didn't have a license for the next 3 years because of that. And I could have gotten my license much sooner. But I'm the type of person who can't stay sober long enough to make it through a DUI class. So I went to those DUI classes for a while, and then I showed up drunk one too many times. They sent me back to court to get reinstated into that DUI class, and I just never did it. And I just ignored that thing and ultimately ignored the consequences of that DUI for 8 years. And I'll tell that story in just a little while of how that ended for me. So here I am. I find myself in beautiful Southern California, no car, but living within walking distance to where I worked and really having a good time. I would go work every day and then go to the bar every night and had access to, all the drugs that I possibly wanted working at that restaurant. And I can tell you, I was not drinking normally. I like to say, it turns out they have drugs in Long Beach, California, and I found them. So that was it. And what happened is, after working for about a year at this restaurant, I met a woman who was working there, and we got along really, really well and fell in love. And she had a 6-month-old daughter, and the dad wasn't in the picture. And me being a young, naive, very active alcoholic, I say, yeah, I'm going to step in. Let's make a family. And I'm going to raise this little girl as my own. And I promise you that I will stop doing drugs. And we did just that. We moved in together and started this family, and this little baby was 6 months old, and I stopped doing drugs. Now, for me, when I say I stopped doing drugs, I smoked weed and I drank every single day for the next several years. But I did. I stopped doing the hard drugs that I'd been doing that were causing a lot of problems for me. I want to tell you that little girl is 13 years old now. And she's my daughter, and I absolutely love her with my whole heart. And I tell that story sometimes and we'll get like an oh's and you're a good guy and stuff like that. But I also have to tell you that her growing up with me caused trauma for her, and she had to witness and experience some really hard things that I'm going to talk about next and that I'm not proud of. But I absolutely love the fact that little girl is in my life, and that for the last several years, for the last 5+ years, she's had a dad who's been consistent and loving and nurturing and caring and present for her. And I'm absolutely grateful for that. So what happened is I make this promise that I'm going to stop doing drugs, and I'm drinking and I'm smoking weed every day still, and ultimately get a job outside the restaurant that, you know, I had to put a tie on for work sometimes and got to travel a lot and was kind of working this job that I didn't exactly feel qualified for, but I had some success at in the beginning, and it felt exciting. It felt like, you know, maybe the first, I think, year of that job felt like maybe I've got this alcoholism thing beat. And that's one thing about my drinking is I was always aware that I was an alcoholic, because when I grew up, I had my dad telling me, you're going to be an alcoholic. And then my experience from drinking very early on was that, that of an alcoholic, right? So I'm working this job, acutely aware of my alcoholism, but thinking maybe I'm beating it. At least the people around me don't know what's going on. And I had some success in this job, and we were, the three of us were, my daughter's mother and I were able to rent a house, and the thing actually had a white picket fence around the house. And on the outside, I think it looked good for a couple of years. And on the inside, I was slowly dying. I would get in my car and drive 15 miles, and it would take me an hour and a half in the morning and sometimes 2 hours at night. And I learned that there was a liquor store near my office where I would get myself a little something for the road on the way home. And then that little something for the road turned into, you know, a little something in the afternoon. And then that turned into maybe something at noon. And then that turned into me ultimately drinking all day, every day at work and not doing a very good job while I was there. I had this sense for the last, I worked at this place for about 4 years, and I had this sense for the last 2 years that I worked there that my life was this house of cards that was bound to come crumbling to the ground, that the people around me were going to figure out who and what I was, that I wasn't really doing my job, and that I was going to lose everything that I had precariously kind of, I don't want to even say built, but had been given. And basically that exact thing happened. And I was able to find a catalyst to make it happen a little bit more quickly. And that catalyst came in the form of meth. So I'm in this house with this white picket fence, and it's been about 5 years since I made that promise that I was never going to do drugs again. My daughter goes to the elementary school that's literally right across the street from our house. And it's a nice neighborhood, but four doors down, there's this guy who's a tweaker. And I knew he was a tweaker because he was a tweaker. And I don't know what got into me. Well, I do know what got into me is I think I wanted to get high, right? And I walked over there one day with a joint rolled and said, do you want to get high? And we smoked that joint. And then he looked at me and he said, do you want to get high? And I started smoking meth again every day immediately. And here was my experience, is it took me two and a half months to lose that job, 4 months to lose that house. It was out of control immediately. I had done meth when I was a kid, and it was much, much more expensive in Des Moines, like 10 times more expensive. So I see the prices here, and I can afford it. I can afford to do more than I had ever done. And that was my life for the next 3 years. I lost that job and went into two treatment centers that first year. Within the first 6 months, I was already trying to get off of it, and I couldn't get myself to stay in a treatment center long enough for it to do any good. I would, and you know, this is, I had this background of sobriety. I remembered what it was like to be sober. I remembered I grew up in these treatment centers, right? And I just could not get myself to stay. And I would come up with these excuses to leave. One time I was there for 2 weeks and somebody physically threatened me, and I was gone. The next time I showed up to this treatment center, an active cigarette smoker, but decided because I'm sober, I'm not going to smoke cigarettes anymore. I'm just going to chew tobacco because it's healthier. And I chewed tobacco at this place for about 2 weeks until they told me that chewing tobacco wasn't allowed there anymore. So I packed my stuff and left in an outrage and said, if I can't chew tobacco here, I'm not going to be here at all. And I walked out and bought myself a pack of cigarettes and was high later that day. That was kind of my experience. Anytime I would try to get sober, the longest that I was able to stay sober in this time period was literally 3 days from the time that I started doing meth to the time that I ultimately got sober. So I didn't know what I was going to do. And I sort of embraced this idea that this is just what my life looks like now, and that it's going to end in suicide, and that it's going to be really sad for everybody. But when I can finally get the courage to do that, that at least I'll be gone from this. And what happened is, like I said, we lost that house, and my daughter's mother's parents said that she and our daughter could move in and that I wasn't welcome there. And so the three of us moved in, and it was just kind of like that. I said, I'm here. What are you going to do about it? And I wasn't welcome there. And I was getting my meth from, under the bridge on the riverbed, and spending more and more and more of my time there, because there, my people were there and I was more comfortable there than I was anywhere else, really. What my life looked like is, for 10 hours a day, I would sit in this tiny bathroom at the house where I wasn't welcome, and I would do what I did in there. And then I would get up and I would get on my skateboard, and I would ride to the riverbed, and I would hang out under the bridge and ride my skateboard around some more and do what I could to get money to get high. I had lost that job and gone back to serving tables at a restaurant, and I'm 30 years old, riding a skateboard around all the time, doing a terrible job serving tables. If you had me as a server, you didn't have a good experience. I can tell you that. And you might've gotten a little bit of sweat dripped into your food, and I'm so sorry about that. But that was what it looked like for me. And it got to a point where that serving job was too hard, and I had to let him know, after multiple no call, no shows, that I was going to go to treatment. And they called me into an office one day after having, not shown up for a shift again, and said, "What's going on with you?" And I started crying, and I said, "I'm addicted to meth." And the look on the poor restaurant manager's face when I said that, I'll never forget. But they were kind, and they told me, get you a treatment center and get yourself taken care of, and you'll have a job here when you come back. And so one day, when things were in chaos, on Father's Day weekend of 2018, I called on that Friday, which holiday weekends at restaurants are very busy. I called on that Friday and I said, "I'm not going to be able to come this weekend. And I don't think I'm going to come again until I go to treatment." And it took me 6 more weeks to get there. So I did what I could to get money in that 6 weeks and spent very little time at the house where I would usually sleep, and spent a lot of time under a bridge, and felt really, really at home there. So on Father's Day weekend, after having told the restaurant that I wasn't going to be there, I went and knocked at the treatment center where I would ultimately go. And they told me that they didn't do intakes on the weekend, that I would have to come back. As I was driving back to the house from that trip, something felt really, really off. And the next thing I remember, I'm waking up on the bathroom floor inside that house, being told that I need to go to the hospital. And I wake up in the hospital on the day before Father's Day, having been told that I had had a mini stroke. They told me straight out, if you keep doing meth, you're going to die. So I'm in the hospital overnight, and my daughter doesn't want to come see me on Father's Day because of the chaos that I had been creating in the house and in her life and in her mom's life. And I asked her mom to bring me a specific pair of jeans that I had at the house, and that I would get myself home. And in that jeans, I knew that I had a bag of dope. And I went into the bathroom at that hospital room where they told me that if I kept doing meth, I was going to die. And I got high in that bathroom. And then I left kind of as if nothing had happened. And I continued to live the way that I had been living for about 3 more weeks. I leave the hospital and I live the way that I had been living for 3 more weeks and showed up to that same treatment center one more time. And it was July 3rd. They said, we can't check you in on July 4th. But if you make it here on July 5th at 8 o'clock, you'll have a bed. And I said, okay. And left, spent July 4th doing exactly what I described that I've been doing for the years leading up to that. I rode my skateboard and I spent time under a bridge and I got high, and I knew that I was going to be leaving for treatment for 3 months. And my daughter's mother was at work on July 4th. I found myself on a skateboard going down hills, and I was at the top of a hill at 9 o'clock on 4th of July. And I saw fireworks going off from, I was on a hill tall enough to see fireworks going off from multiple cities, fireworks shows around the area that I was in. And I thought, wow, this is beautiful. And then it struck me that my daughter was sitting at home, you know, maybe with her grandparents, but certainly not with me. And her mom was at work. And just how selfish I was, that I know that I'm going to leave for 3 months and can't even be bothered to spend the night with my daughter. So I ended up checking myself into that treatment center, and I knew this time that it wasn't going to work. On the way there, I flushed a bag of meth for the first time in my entire life and smoked a blunt on the way there and threw it out when it was about halfway gone, and checked into this treatment center on July 5th, 2018, knowing that I was going to end up leaving in a few days and planning that when I did, that I would commit suicide. I had left the same treatment center before. It's right near the 710 freeway in Long Beach. And I remember the first time I left, walking over a bridge to find a bus and looking down the bridge that goes over the freeway and thinking, man, I wish I had the courage to do it. I checked into this treatment center and thought, this time I will, because I know that it's not going to work for me this time. And obviously I sit here today and that's not what I did. What I did is I started to go to every single group, and I described what happened to me as having a window of willingness. And I had experienced this window of willingness as early as being 15 years old, checking myself into a treatment center, or getting checked into a treatment center, I should say, but telling myself that I'm going to get sober. And what happens for me over and over and over in my countless efforts at sobriety is that this window of willingness opens and I can feel the fresh air and I can see the joy that other people are living through the other side of this window. And then before I know it, it snaps shut in front of me. And I don't get to decide when that window of willingness opens again. And I felt this window open, and I knew that this time it really might actually be life or death for me. And so I stepped all the way through that window, and I sat all the way down in my chair. I sat in the front row of groups, and I sat in the front row of H&I panels, and I decided, I'm going to take full advantage of this willingness right here, right now. When I was 9 days sober, I went to an H&I panel at the treatment center, like many, many H&I panels that I had been to in the past. And I heard somebody tell a story very similar to mine. This guy looked different than me. He was older than me. He was from a different part of the country than me, but he drank like I did and he did dope like I did. And most importantly is I believed him when he said that he had been relieved of the obsession to drink. And when he said that, it struck me that at my many, many attempts at sobriety, when I had 2.5 years of sobriety at one point, I had never been relieved of the obsession to drink. And I thought, man, maybe this guy can show me how he did that. Maybe this guy can show me how that's possible. So I asked him to be my sponsor and I started calling him every single day. And he didn't tell me to call him every day. You know where that came from was past attempts at sobriety, past sponsors saying to call them every day and giving me a hard time if I didn't. And I say that to say that when I was 15 years old, there probably weren't many people who thought that I was going to get sober, but there were people who took the time to come speak with me and plant the seeds of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I actually had the willingness to live a different way of life, those seeds had taken root and I knew what to do. So I called this man every single day while I was in treatment, and we had to use a payphone or ask to borrow a phone from the treatment counselors. And I found a way to make that happen. And then we started to work the steps. He came into that treatment center and sat with me once a week, and he was able to take me to meetings outside. And I remember sitting in my first meeting outside of that treatment center and remembering a sense of peace that I felt when I was a child, sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with my mom and my dad, well before I ever took my first drink. And I hung on to that feeling. I got out of that treatment center and checked into an outpatient treatment center. And I continued to do the deal and I continued to work the steps. I lived in the sober living house for 4 months after that treatment center. And I'm going to outpatient. And I got to go back to work at that restaurant where I told them that I was addicted to meth. And they gave me a second chance. And from my outpatient treatment counselor's computer, I applied to go to school at a university in Southern California. And the application process was so daunting that I started crying. I didn't have a computer of my own. I had to find transcripts from many years before. And I thought, gosh, if this application process is so difficult, how the heck am I going to actually do school? Well, I found out through the application process that I still had to take a few classes at community college to be able to go to the university that I wanted to go to. And at 6 months of sobriety, I went and bought myself a backpack and showed up to this community college, and I sat in the front row and I took those classes, and I wasn't sure how it was going to do. I thought that, you know, maybe I had done some permanent damage to my brain, and that I wouldn't be able to do school. And it turns out I was, and I got A's in those first three classes, and built a lot of confidence in that process. I ended up going to that university. And I did really, really well and had a great time. Part of my school, like many, many people, was right during COVID. So I spent 1.5 semesters on campus. And then COVID lockdowns happened and spent another year on Zoom, and then got to spend my last semester on campus and had a great experience. And I majored in English, originally thinking that I would teach high school English. And then I got into a high school classroom and thought, oh, I really, really don't want to do this. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. And I think the beauty of sobriety and education for me is that I get to have an open mind and get to learn who I am and what I'm interested in. I took a political science class on Zoom that was required for my major, and I was one of four students in this large 100-plus person lecture class who had their cameras on. And so the professor knew who I was, and I did the reading before class and came prepared and was able to answer questions. And that professor reached out to me and said that there was a judicial internship program through the school that I should apply for. And I told him, oh, well, I'm an English major and I haven't really taken any legal classes, so I don't think that I would be qualified. And he said, well, I run the program and I'm the person who selects the candidates, so I think you should apply. And I did. I said, okay, I'll give this a shot. And it was supposed to be at a superior courthouse, but again, because of COVID, he had to change the program. And what it ended up being was a series of attorneys from all over the country coming to speak to our small class via Zoom. And I sat through these talks and fell in love with the idea of a legal career, fell in love with this idea that I can use my intelligence and my experience to help many, many people outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as well. So I thought, maybe I can do this. I reached out to a couple of those attorneys who spoke to our class to just kind of brainstorm what it would take to get from graduating with an English degree to ending up in law school. Through one of those conversations, one of those attorneys offered me a job. He's a federal criminal defense attorney who takes court-appointed cases for people who can't afford an attorney. And I got to work for that man for 2 years and see what he did. And I got to bring my experience into that job, helping people who are a lot like us, a lot of times experiencing the absolute most difficult times of their lives because of addiction. And in that job, I didn't tell people necessarily about my experience with addiction because it wouldn't be appropriate. In one case, I did, and it made a lot of sense in that case. But I was able to speak to these people without judgment, with a sense of caring and compassion and understanding of trauma and of these terrible feelings of shame and guilt and not knowing what's next, and be there and tell these people's stories through. I got to write sentencing motions, and I got to write diversion applications where I'm telling really the court about these people's lives beyond and apart from their criminal allegations. And I say all that to say that I absolutely fell in love with the work. So in this process, I started to submit applications for law school. And to make a long story short, I'm in my second semester at a law school here in Los Angeles and absolutely loving what I do. It's very, very, very difficult. It's more work than I knew that it would be a lot of work. And I think it's more work than I possibly could have understood, but I'm doing it and I'm on the front lines of my life and chasing a dream that seemed like just absolutely wouldn't have been possible for a guy who was spending most of his time under a bridge 6 years ago. My life in Alcoholics Anonymous looks a little bit different than it did even a year ago. You know, a year ago, I was right before school started, I was going to 5 meetings a week and always sponsoring brand new people out of treatment centers. And I knew when school started that I would have to change that routine a little bit. And I absolutely still sponsor today. I'm not on the front lines in H&I the way that I was for the first 4 years of my sobriety. And I have to say, this is school started and, you know, I'm somebody who had gone to 4 to 5 meetings a week for my entire sobriety, and school started and it became busy and suddenly I find myself going to 0 to 1 meetings per week for the first few weeks of school. And things felt crazy. And I wasn't able to, you know, I had a sponsor who said, maybe you should go to some more meetings, Dustin. And I said, you don't understand, I don't have time. And things felt crazy. And I didn't have time to do even my schoolwork. And I ended up going to the psychologist on campus that's offered for students, and told him about myself. And he said, I think you need to be going to more meetings. And all of a sudden something clicked that yeah, maybe I'm in trouble. I found a meeting 5 minutes from my school that meets every single day at 7:15 in the morning. And I've been going to that meeting a few times a week, and immediately it was the same experience that I had at that first meeting that my sponsor took me to from the treatment center, where I felt that sense of peace and comfort that I felt as a child going to meetings with my parents. Is I stepped into this meeting and immediately knew that everything was okay again. So since then, I've been going to, again, 3 to 4 meetings a week. I actually reached out to student services and asked about starting a meeting on campus, and they let me do that. So far, it's two of us that show up. So it's a 20-minute meeting, but I suspect that we'll maybe get some more interest and participation at some point. But I do know that I'm going to keep showing up. And the last thing I'll say is that relationship with that little girl's mom ended up not working as my sobriety kind of grew. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. I didn't know especially what that was going to look like with my daughter. And what has happened is she has just remained a very, very important person in my life. I have her from Friday night until Sunday evening, every weekend. And she's the light of my life. She is, she's kind of the most important thing to me and keeps me going. And I'm so grateful for her. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for the life that I have today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dustin. I'm going to ask you questions, but first, there was one story, at least one story hanging, and that was the DUI that you ignored for 8 years, and you were going to tell us how that ended.
So, shortly before I got sober, the year that I got sober, while things were so chaotic, while the police were showing up at the house somewhat regularly because I couldn't stop yelling, they showed up one day and I wasn't able to scurry away on my skateboard quick enough for them not to catch me. And they put me in the back of a police car and told me that I had some bench warrants for not taking care of that DUI 8 years before, and for not taking care of a couple of drinking in public type charges that I got since then. And they took me to jail, and I ended up sitting in LA County jail for about a week and got it carted around to a few different courthouses, where it turns out I found out you can sit in jail for about 7 days and have that be your punishment instead of several thousand dollars worth of fines. So that was my experience with taking care of that DUI. But it also, that police contact is kind of also what led toward me ultimately not being welcome at that house and being ready to get sober.
Nice. What about your folks?
So my dad has been sober since 1990. He lives in Detroit, and he is my best friend. He and I talk on the phone almost every day. And when we get together, we do Alcoholics Anonymous together. He is nearing retirement age and it talks about maybe coming to California, although I doubt it. He loves his home in Detroit, but you know, I think he came out here during COVID to take his 30-year chip at a beach meeting. And I think he could not be happier with the fact that his son is sober and doing well in Alcoholics Anonymous.
And
so I think a good way to ask that question is, what about your dad?
All right, we'll leave it there. We'll leave it there. Okay. It's very sweet. We'll leave it there. Okay. So you have an amazing relationship with your dad, and I hope he gets to hear this because you said he's your best friend. And as a parent, that is the sweetest sentiment ever.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. What else do I got here? You were always aware that you were an alcoholic. Was there anything that your parents could have said or done to postpone that drinking and smoking that you started at 13?
I think absolutely not. I think that they did everything that they could do to try to kind of avoid that. And, you know, I'm sure that they asked themselves that same question too. But I think that that's just kind of the type of kid that I was. And I think about that. My daughter's 13 years old now, and I can't see her doing it. But I think that that's just kind of, I think that was just inevitable for me.
And I would like to know more about this treatment centers that call themselves treatment centers, but look like jail. Is there any better option for parents that have a 15-year-old that need treatment? Or is what is out there across the table these things that are posing as one thing, but really kids are experiencing it as if it's jail?
Yeah, I love that. And I think that experience and kind of the criminalization of my experience as a young drug addict is a lot of what I'm interested in professionally. The experience that the juveniles have in this criminal system, a lot because of addiction, is I think really disheartening and frustrating. And I don't know what the answer is, but I think that almost always the answer is not to remove a kid from home, remove a kid from school, if at all possible. I feel like I missed a big, big part of my childhood that, you know, I mean, things certainly weren't easy for my parents, and I don't blame them for any decisions that they made. And ultimately, I think the courts made most of those decisions for them. But I think that I try to wonder what I would do if my daughter were behaving the way that I was behaving when I was that age. And I don't know what the answer is. But I do know that I would do everything that I could to keep her in the home. And I also know that many years later, my dad ultimately went to Al-Anon and found peace and comfort there. And I'm sure that at the time that I was 15, he wishes that he would have gone right away.
That's a perfect answer. Is there anything that you're thinking of now or that you left out of your story that you'd like to share or bring up?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Final question for the alcoholic listening. What message would you like to leave with them, newcomer or otherwise?
Yeah. For the newcomer, I love you. I want you to know that when I was 15 years old, when I was 18 years old, when I was 21 years old, when I was 28 years old, I was 30 years old, I promised myself that I was going to get sober and that I was going to stay sober for the rest of my life. And I kept breaking that promise to myself over and over and over. And so what I would say to you right now is that window of willingness is open, jump all the way through and sit all the way down and do this thing. And if you fall down one more time, all I ask is that you get back up.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.